Hi, this is Jerry Williams, retired FBI agent. I'm the author of FBI Crime Fiction. You might want to read my book, Pay to Play. And you're listening to Gangland Wire.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
We're back here in the classic old Ice House building with my good friend Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
And we also have on the line for the second and final episode our friend from Chicago, Frank Calabrese Jr. Hello, Frank.
Hi, guys. How are you doing tonight?
Good. Great to have you back. That was a really good interview you gave us and a really great insight into mob life. You know, it humanizes what people, many people, they see the Godfather and the glamour of that, and they see even the Goodfellas or Casino, and you only see this kind of work glamour side of that. But we heard what it's like to grow up in that life, and it's really interesting. I like doing that, Frank. I like to show mob fans that it's not all this glamour. It's not all this glitz. It's not big money. It's not the ability to influence all the politicians and judges that they can, although those things do happen, but there's a flip side to that life, and a lot of people are hurt out of that. And so it's really been enlightening and entertaining to talk with you, and we're going to continue this in a little darker subject that you ended up testifying about. We talked a lot about your dad, Frank Calabrese Sr., but he had a brother, Nick Calabrese. He and your dad kind of developed into a pretty cold and efficient hit team up there in Chicago that were used a lot by those guys. Can you tell a little bit about that, what you ended up having to testify to?
Well, yeah, my dad and my uncle were... Yeah, they were part of a crew that that was very good at what they did. It was a crew that we would call do heavy work. They killed a lot of people. The bosses preferred using them because they got it done in a timely manner. They did it right, and they were good at what they did.
Now, your Uncle Nick, he from what I read and what I have read, he seemed like he was more the point man, shall we say, on doing that heavy work. Is that the way you saw it? Is that the way it was?
Again, when you're going to kill somebody and they're first going to ask you if you're going to do it, they're going to test you all the way through. And that's what happened with my uncle on his first murder. It was a guy named Albergo. He was a Juice Sloan tough guy that worked with the crew. And he made the fatal mistake of saying that if he got this subpoena and he went to jail, he wasn't going alone, that you guys were, that the rest of the guys were coming with. And at that point, my uncle thought he was being tested that night, and he wasn't being tested. He really had to kill somebody. He'd only been in the life for a year with my dad, and that really changed his life right there, because once you're in, you're in. My uncle was a soldier. He was in the Navy. My uncle was very good at what he did. A lot of people didn't know that my uncle was this deep. A lot of people didn't know that my dad and my uncle killed people. People on the street thought that we just had this gambling and juice loans. People didn't know the depth that was involved with the Calabrese family. Once my uncle was in, you know, yeah, he was my father's assistant. You know, he killed along with Ronnie Jarrett. My father, my uncle Ronnie Jarrett, killed a lot of guys, the three of them. Later on in life, when my dad had some surgery and he wasn't feeling good, my uncle was ordered to go out and do it with other people that he hadn't worked with before. And that's what he did. He happened to make a fatal mistake on one of the hits. He wound up shooting himself in the struggle. And later on, that's what led to the bloody glove.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, tell that story of the bloody glove.
Well, real quick, there was a gentleman, John Picarata. He had fell out of favor with the bosses. He had done a couple of things against our family. It was given to my dad and my uncle to kill him, but John was a smart street guy. And if my dad and my uncle went together to meet John, he would have caught the play. So my uncle actually did it himself. And when he did it himself, John caught the play. There was a struggle. My uncle wound up shooting himself at shooting John. John got the bullets out of the gun, but my uncle had a backup gun. He had to chase him through a gangway. And in the middle of the street, he executed him on his knees because he knew he had to kill him. If he didn't kill him, that there would have been a death sentence for him and my dad, and possibly me. Later on, years later, when my uncle started cooperating, that bloody glove was one of the things that tied him into that murder.
I read about that, back then, some alert policeman saw that bloody glove laying there and bagged it up, put it in the evidence room, and basically forgot about it. It was just one more unsolved Chicago outfit hit on the streets. And then years later when...
All right, well, the glove was away from the scene. He found it like a block away, and also they didn't have DNA back then.
Right, so flash forward to modern times, and when people start talking in order to verify what they're saying, that maybe your Uncle Nick was involved with this particular murder. You know, anybody can say that, but somebody can say that, and then they say, and there's a glove out there that has got his blood on it, or they go in and look at the evidence log and say, here's a bloody glove. Now we have DNA. Let's get a warrant or an order to get DNA from our suspect, and then let's compare that glove. I guess that's what those two Chicago policemen were alerting him to, that somebody was getting into the evidence room, the FBI, and getting that bloody glove out, and then they knew about DNA by then. Is that how that came down?
Well, when I started cooperating, I explained, because I was the one that had to retrieve the gun from a sewer. I was the, they basically knew it was my uncle that did it. So they were able to get DNA and then at the same time go get his blood and actually look at the bullets in his arm through an x-ray. So, because there were some of the bullets left in his arm still.
Is that what made his decision to go ahead and give evidence?
No, there was. It wasn't. My father gave his blessing to have him killed in prison because when I started wearing a wire against my dad, he was jealous of my uncle was trying to poison our minds against him, and that wasn't the real reason. And that wasn't what really happened. And my dad actually gave permission to have my uncle killed in another prison. There was an attempt made on his life, and it was compromised. And once that happened, between what the FBI had on my uncle already and them trying to kill him, and his own brother giving the okay, that's what made him cooperate.
Oh, okay.
It was more than just that.
I'm just reading here on the Wikipedia about your uncle. It said that he had also admitted in court taking part in 14 murders ordered by La Pietra, which it says here includes the hits on Michael Albergo and then the John, the guy you're talking about, Fecorata.
Right, Fecorata.
But did he get convicted of that? It doesn't seem like it says that here.
But he pled guilty to all those murders, and then he wound up, and then he got sentenced at the end, okay? He cooperated, got sentenced at the end. He did more time than any other cooperating witness in the history of anybody cooperating. For what he gave to them and for what he, you got to remember in this case, in all of the history of Chicago gangland wars, there was, I don't know, between 1,200 gangland murders and only 3 to 5 convicted. In this case alone, 18 were convicted and over 40 was solved. My uncle helped them solve a lot of those murders, high profile murders, helped them solve Giancana's murder.
Oh, yeah, they did, didn't they? Remind me of that. I'd forgotten about that. What was the deal on Giancana's murder?
Well, my father and Ronnie Jarrett made the silencer for the hit. I never said that who did it, although everybody thinks it's Butch Blassie or Tony Spilaccio. I can tell you that it wasn't either one of them.
Okay.
Well, that's probably about the extent I'm going to tell you right now. The FBI does know who did it. They know all about it. The gun was retrieved not far from the scene. The FBI was outside the house surveilling Sam Giancana that day. I can tell you that on one of the future tours soon, I will be saying who did it.
All right. Great. That's.
I just want to document it that it's my tours, the one you heard it from.
Sorry. All right.
Sorry, guys. Well. Doing your hair.
No, okay. I understand. You got to hold back that little bit. You got to have that little bit extra special. I feel you, brother.
I'm kind of.
Yeah, and once I do say it, it's going to get out. It'll get out, and everybody's going to claim that they were the ones that do.
Yeah.
So I need a little bit of you guys understand.
It's like the special sauce, right?
Special sauce, yeah. It's like the secret special sauce.
You've got to give them, it's kind of like, you know, when people ask you the Calabrese necktie, is it a single or double Windsor?
Yeah. Oh, we're laughing about this. We're laughing about this, but sometimes you just got to laugh, don't you, Frank? Otherwise, you'd cry.
Yeah, you know.
Well, and you did. You were on the stand sitting there testifying against your own father.
That had to be hard, Frank. That had, any way you cut it, there it was. It had to be tough.
Sure was. It is to this day. You know, I was hoping it didn't come down to that. You know, and it was. And you know, I mean, you know, I went into prison. Me and my father made some promises. You know, my promise to him was the drugs. Don't do them or sell them ever again. And I kept that promise to this day. His promise was to not try to pull me back in that life. And then I also mentioned to him that he should back down because he could semi-retire because he was sick. Right? He didn't keep his promise. When I got in prison with him, trying to work out our differences because we had a lot for 8 months when I was in the same prison, and I tried to work out our difference. Long story short, when I realized not only he had no plans of backing out of this, he had plans to bring me back into it. Once I was able to see and prove that for sure, I had to make decisions. And, you know, sometimes you got to make a decision, a life decision, and your choices all suck, but you got to pick one of them. I had to think about my kids, about my life. I had to think about the people around me. It had nothing to do with my time or being in prison because the deal I made with the FBI was a business deal. I'll do all my time. I'll pay all my debt. I'm going to assist you to keep him locked up. And that was it. That was it. Bottom line. And this trial that was an historical trial, all I did was open up the doors. I just testified pretty much against my dad. It was what they did to my, tried to do to my uncle, and it just opened up the doors for the FBI to take down the whole upper echelon of Chicago mob, which was left.
Really, it was a historic, and it all started, from what I understand, and there's a copy of this letter in your book. What I understand, it started with your letter to an FBI agent saying, you know, I've had enough.
Yeah, I didn't even know which agent to send it to, so I went in my pre-sentencing investigation paperwork. I found a name, and I typed the name on there. I typed it because I didn't want it to know handwriting. I wore gloves. I put nothing personal there. So in case I got compromised, I could tell my dad it must be the FBI. You know, months and months passed before they came. At first, they thought I was not, you know, that I was having a hard time doing my time. They asked me what I wanted, you know. And then in the end, you know, they realized that, no, that wasn't the case. So they knew I was in it, and I knew what I had to do.
I was reading some of the stories that you had in the other interviews, and it talked about how you, where you were there basically in the yard in the prison with your father wearing a wire, and you had gotten a tattoo, which you're not supposed to, of course, in prison, and he wanted to see it, which was kind of a tense moment, I would imagine, because you might reveal yourself.
Oh, sure. Sure, he just got done telling me everybody that was involved in his Falacho murders. He got done telling me a bunch of very sensitive stuff. He looks at me with that look, and when he seen him look at me and start grabbing at my sweatshirt. Well, the problem was that day that I happened to go out there, I needed to go out there because he wanted to talk about this stuff. Well, the wire went bad at the FBI, and they gave me a big metal box and a jock strap to put between my legs, and I was wired up like a Christmas tree.
He told me
I didn't have to do it, but I knew I had to do it. You know, he went to grab my shirt, and I thought he found out, and I didn't know if I should run, punch him. But you got to remember, I'm by the bocce court. So there's guys from different cities there and a guard that would turn his back in a second. I was going to punch him and run. I didn't know what to do, and I'm pulling my shirt down, arguing with him, and then finally he says he wants to get a tattoo at that point. I realized that it was just a tattoo, so I told him, I said, the guard's right there. If you pull my shirt up now, I'm going to the hole. He said, well, I want to see it later. So, you know, and then the FBI realized and myself that, you know, we can only get so lucky for so long because when I went out on the yard, I was not monitored. I was given a wire, and I went, and I was gone for 3 to 5 hours. And I came back, or the alarm went off, and I'm dead on the yard. So they couldn't monitor me. They sat and waited for me. So the danger level was so, so high that finally that was it. That was the last recording, or the second to the last recording. I transferred to another prison, and that's what from that point on.
I wonder if they still have those in the court files at all. That would be some amazing recording material.
Yeah,
they do have that. They do have that that audio. I've done some speaking engagements with one of the agents, and they have that.
So Frank, we're gonna. You've been with us a long time with your other episode, and we really appreciate you coming back on this last one. Tell us a little bit about your life since the trial. I noticed you didn't go into witness protection program. You kept your name. So what happened to you after the trial?
Oh, I mean, I had to live life. I had to start over. Okay, I moved to Arizona, and my family a second chance at life. I've been in Arizona for the last 15 years, worked for Marriott for 10 years. I had to start over. I had to work twice as hard as anybody else. And work my way back up. I didn't pick witness protection. I didn't want to go on witness protection. I felt that, I had to take my chances on the street. I grew up with these guys. I know how they operate. I know how they think. So I did my best to survive. There was a lot of guys on the street I could have gotten in trouble. A lot of major politicians in this country I could have gotten in trouble, but that's not why I was cooperating. I was cooperating against my dad. A lot of these guys seen that I didn't follow them. Okay, so maybe they didn't take it as personal. After a while, I don't know. I got lucky because between the time that I left prison and well before the trial came, I want to say before it even came out that I was cooperating, five or six guys either died naturally or got killed, and those were the guys that I would have had to worry about. You know, I live my life every day. I live it to the fullest. I take everything I learned on the street and use it in a positive way. Try to do the right thing.
And so your father died in prison, that correct?
Yeah, he died on Christmas Day in 2012.
Was he still in Missouri? I saw that he had been placed in Missouri, I think.
He down in Springfield?
No, he went down to a prison in the southeast. I don't know if it was South Carolina, North Carolina. I forgot what it was. Butner? I'm not sure. I'd have to look, but he was in a special lockup because he threatened the prosecutor. He put a $150,000 hit on my head, and he had his associates put a fake bomb on my brother's porch during jury deliberation. So with all that going on, they put him in this special Sam's lockup. Mostly all terrorists are in there, and if anybody, and one other Italian from New York that made a hit list of prosecutors and judges. So he spent almost 4 years, his last 4 years in there, locked down in a hole.
Well, he went out the hard way.
He died of heart failure.
Yeah.
And your uncle?
I don't talk about my uncle, anything after the trial. The reason I don't, because for security reasons, I promised the FBI that I wouldn't talk about him at all. That you would have to talk to the FBI about.
All right, so take us, Frank, take us a little bit, give us a taste of what you do on that tour, like, kind of like the general areas and what people were likely to see on your tour.
So, you know, I came here for the summer. I've been back in Chicago for the summer, back to the old restaurant where I was partners at. I'm sitting here and I'm noticing, you know, Chicago's changed a lot. I've noticed that specialty tours now are a big thing. And I had seen a couple of the crime tours, was mostly geared towards Al Capone. I says, you know what? I says, I was thinking about maybe I should do a tour, but I'll do it myself. I'm telling my story, and I'll take you around. I can't go out to the far neighborhoods because it's only a less than two-hour tour. And I did it based off my New York Times bestseller. I'm working on a TV program and a major motion picture, so that is working on and making some progress. I figured, why not start now? You come on the tour. I'm your tour guide. On your tour, you're going to hear stories. You're going to hear stories that you don't read in history books. I'm going to take you through a timeline. I'm going to start all the way back to the bootlegger wars. I'll take you through that a little bit because on my Irish side, I had some ties. My Irish family fought against Al Capone. I talk about that on the tour. Take you through the Rush Street area that was mob run for many years. I take you through the Old Town area that was mob run for many years. I take you to the three Italian neighborhoods down here that were Little Italy's. I take you to the Grand and Ogden. I take you to Taylor Street. I take you to 26th Street. Tell you many stories about things that happened in the neighborhood, people that came from those neighborhoods. I take you to Chinatown. I take you to two murder sites. I take you to close to the garage where five murders happened. I take you through Chinatown itself, with a little bit with the Chinese mafia working with us. And then I'm going to take you down Dearborn. I'm going to take you to MCC, the federal court buildings. When I say MCC, the Metropolitan Correctional Center, where I spend time at. Federal buildings, I take you through the theater district. I take you over by the river, by Marina Towers. I talk about the bootlegger wars. I take you right in the front line. I talk about my story, how it relates to more of the modern-day mob, and how the modern-day mob had to change, and how they blended in. I take you on the tour, and I tell you a lot of street smarts. I'm going to teach you to think and act the way I did on the street.
That's
and at
a
the
lot
end of the tour,
hours.
You can come on in and have some... Yeah.
That's a lot.
Believe me, it's a fast 2 hours.
So then,
afterwards, I come in the restaurant and you eat. I stay in the restaurant for about an hour and I'll walk around and sit down and answer questions, take pictures, sign books.
Cool. That's a heck of a tour. That's a little bit like what Frank Culotta does out there, but different in many ways. But I think he ends up at a pizza place and they eat pizza. So that is a heck of a tour. People getting their money's worth on that one. I'll have to do that myself when I get up there.
Well, you shared some great stuff here with us tonight, and I'm sure you've got so many more stories.
Yeah, I did. Way more stories. I have so many more stories. I could sit there for hours and hours and tell them. I also do a PowerPoint presentation. So there's a video that starts out. In the PowerPoint presentations, there's a lot of pictures that you've never seen anywhere before. So it's basically like a, speaking engagement, but you're on the bus and I'm taking you to some of the sites where it actually happened. And you're hearing stuff right from the horse's mouth firsthand.
Have you done the Mob Museum yet? They have authors and speakers, and I think they probably pay for that. More than likely have some kind of a...
Yeah, I did something for Frank at the Mob Experience, but I haven't been to the Mob Museum in Vegas yet.
Yeah, because they've got like Mob History Month in January, which sounds like a great time to be in Vegas.
Yeah.
I did Mob History Month with two other gentlemen from New York. And we did at the Clark County Library in front of about 300 people. We were there a handful of years ago. Did it?
We did something
a little different.
I remember that. What did you do that was different? I took my movie out there. I think maybe that same year or the next year.
Okay. Well, the three of us. One, Kenji Gallo, was from L.A. Did a lot of stuff with the Chicago mob. Then went to New York for 7 years and worked with Teddy Persico the whole time undercover. So Kenji will tell you a lot about the West. And then Andrew DiDonno worked with the Gambino family until his boss wanted to have him killed. And so we sit up on the stage and we compare, New York, Chicago, and the West Coast. And we tell stories, and we tell stories how we did stuff. And so we combine all three our stories into one. A lot of fun. People love it.
Oh, I can imagine that.
And at the end, we talk about the last 17 to 20 years of our life, how we changed and how, we have to process every day. Because remember something, we're good at what we did. You learned something. Everybody wants to change their life, right? I want to lose weight. I want to get another job. I want to be good. I don't want to be bad anymore. But when push comes to shove and you're starving and you need a roof over your head, you go back to what you know. So we have a support group because when things like that start to get into our head, we can talk to one another, and we talk each other out of it. Because what's the residual rate? I think it's like 92% or something. The guys go back.
Recidivism?
Yeah, yes. Most people go back. You're right. All three are doing well. I need to get Kenji on the show one of these days.
We talked with Andrew DiDonato.
Yeah.
And he's in sort of a similar situation. Where he's an author, he's got a book, he's got a situation that I was surprised how kind of fresh it was in terms of time. I mean, even the Family Secrets trial, not that long ago.
Right. So, and we, like I said, we're all close by now. Actually, Kenji was on the tour Sunday. So, and he got up and talked a little bit. So not only did you hear me on the tour, but you had another gentleman in the life end up and give you a couple of stories.
Right. Well, Frank, this has been great. We'll let you get on about your business. I know you're doing something there at your restaurant. Aaron, you look like you're frantically trying to come up with another question.
No, I'm trying to clear my throat so I can repeat the website for folks.
Okay. Aaron's going to give he's got the great radio voice. He's going to give your website information and all that. Go ahead, Aaron.
You need to get that information by listening to the entire episode. It's in both episodes, but at the beginning and the end. Don't forget to get in touch with Frank Calabrese to take his Family Secrets tour, which is online at familysecretstours.com, or you can email them at familysecrettour@gmail.com. Give them a call to set up an appointment at 847-261-4435.
And buy his book.
What's the name of that book, Frank?
Operation Family Secret. By Random House. Go online. You can go to Amazon. It's Frank Calabrese, Keith and Kent Zimmerman, and Paul Pompeian.
And that was number 14 on the New York Times bestseller list, that nonfiction. That's great. That's
14. 14.
With a bullet.
With a bullet, yeah, that's great. I mean, that's that there does not come easily. You know how many thousands of true crime books are out there every year that don't have a smell?
Yeah, well, they didn't have to live it to write it.
Really? All right, Frank, we will let you go. We'll probably continue talking a little bit more and finish
gentlemen.
This down. Thanks a lot, Frank. We'll be in touch.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right, Aaron, that was that was the culmination of a heck of a double episode, wasn't it?
Well, it's quite a way to, I don't know, are we ending the year? It sounds like this is starting the year.
This is starting the year.
It's been 3 years now. We're starting really our fourth season here.
Practically,
in 2018.
Yeah.
And every year we seem to get a little higher caliber criminal.
Yeah, and higher caliber FBI agent or police officer, too. I don't know, we couldn't get much higher caliber than Troy Cole in the Bob Berdella story, but be that as it may, we just had those FBI agents on recently about Paul Rico, the FBI agent that was railroaded by the Tulsa prosecutor. But Frank Calabrese Jr., that is a heck of a story. I mean, that's, you know, the son and the uncle both testify against his father to put him in jail for basically the rest of his life. That had to be something to sit in that family secrets trial and watch that. And they really, he said it called it a historic trial, historic case. It was a historic case. It just about did the Chicago outfit in. And they definitely have never been the same since. Now, John Drummond would say they've really never been the same since the straw man case or the Las Vegas casino skimming, which is, there's some truth to that, but this one just almost was the final, coup, shall we say, really took out a bunch of people. Plus, it exposed them. And when you expose the mob, all those killings that they did, they brought out all those and whatever
18.
There was, 18 killings. These politicians are running for cover. They do not want to be implicated with any of that. And there's a lot of Chicago politicians that will probably breathe easier if they listen to this and they hear that Frank Calabrese Jr. is not talking about anything outside of his father and his uncle in that particular segment of it. They're breathing a lot easier.
Well, just talking about his father, I mean, his father, A, has passed away, and everything he's kind of testified to, that's why I was kind of curious if they somewhere there wasn't still that audio, because, I mean, that was...
Oh, it's out there. It sounds like some FBI agents got copies of it. You don't know what it's like to go get something like that.
Yeah.
You act like just go, oh, yeah, you just go get it. No, you just don't
I just
go
put it out
it.
In the universe, and then some FBI agent listens, well, and next listen. Thing you know, they say, they give us a call like... Like I had that call from the Milwaukee mob.
Yeah, well, it's...
he was like, oh, I got this interview, and he was talking about some stuff, and it's this and that. And I'm like, he was like, do you want me to send it to you? And I go, why? He didn't want you to put it out there, this person he was talking to. So don't send it to me, because...
I don't know what you're talking about, so...
I had a conversation with our friend from the Milwaukee mob.
Right.
And he had an interview with some guy who said some things off the record, and he was going to send it to me. And I said, don't send it to me.
What did he expect us to do?
I don't know. Like, we couldn't play it on the air. I guess he just thought it would be titillating.
Well, maybe so. And here's the deal. With those wiretaps, we played some of those before, and we get complaints that you can't understand anything they say. And it's really frustrating for people. So kind of part of the problem is playing wiretaps. I played those videos, audios from those YouTube videos, but we had a guy here. They're short. And they had a guy here that explained exactly what they were talking about. He really gave a great explanation of it. So that's the kind of audio we need. I guess we had some of those family secrets wiretaps. We could get him back on the phone, or audio from the mic he was wearing. We'd get him back on the phone. We could have him explain those to us. But somebody's got to explain it, and they got to be short. Otherwise, it's kind of distracting for the listener.
Well, I'm sorry. It's not perfect audio. It is a wiretap, or in the case of him wearing a wire.
Now,
the fact that it is actually the people who are the criminals. I mean, the real deal. They are the, much like Frank Calabrese and Frank Culotta. You know, there was something that Frank Calabrese Sr. was saying, you're never going to get that. It's, you can do a recreation.
Yeah.
And, you know, bring in a recreation actor to give the voice of Frank Calabrese Sr. or whatever, but it's never the same to me. Is like, that's that golden material that, because it's that, it's original source material, like what you did to make your movie.
Right. I got a ton of it.
But not easy, easy to get, because you can't just get it.
No, you got to file a motion with the court and then make sure you got the cooperation of the assistant U.S. attorney or the U.S. attorney that was assigned to the case. Then you got to get the cooperation of the FBI. And then you got to go to the FBI office and once more get their cooperation to then go find the tapes. Then you got to hope that they cooperate and give you a machine to duplicate the tapes. Mm-hmm. And then you hope that they also will dig out the transcripts for them, because you can listen to them and they're just like this blur. You have no idea what they say if you don't have the
transcription.
So that's there's the rub. Playing a little, to me is kind of counterproductive. I could play you a lot of real deal audio tapes from bugs and wiretaps and all that, and you can't understand a word they say.
Right, yeah.
Well, I had this one. I sent it.
It's nobody's fault.
I paid a lot of money to try to get this cleared up because it was the greatest soundbite I've ever heard. It was the Milwaukee mob boss talking to his son, Frank Balistrieri, talking to, I believe it was his son, John, or Frank Jr. one, and they're discussing Lefty Rosenthal. And one of them is saying, I've got the transcript so I can read the transcript. I know what it's saying, but even reading the transcript while it plays, I couldn't understand what they were saying. A couple of words here and there. But what he says was he's worrying about Frank and if he is going to testify or something. And Frank Sr. says, oh, I don't think he would do that. And Frank Jr. says, oh, he said, man, he said, you squeeze a Jew, you get a snitch. I mean, it's a great line. You cannot.
It's not a politically correct line.
I know. Well, we're not politically correct on this show, but you cannot understand to listen to it, even reading it.
Can you understand that line?
Just maybe snitch.
Because I know, I think
you can understand snitch if you're reading it the same time.
Yeah, if you're reading it as you're listening to it.
Right.
Because I know if you listen to the intro of the program that I had cut together, and I got online and I got some 911 kind of emergency sounds and some other sound effects. But then layered in with that is the conversation where they're talking about the skim in Vegas.
Yeah, you can hear a little bit of that.
Breaking down it's the slot machines and how they, it's easy to walk out with $3,000 in bills, but $3,000 from the slot machine is not so hard. And they say, to set up a bank inside the casino to process the coins from the slot machines to do the skim. And then the guy goes, do it, which was super clear.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that's in that intro. Right up to the point, that was like the cutaway to be like, do it.
Yeah.
And I know when I was talking with these guys who came in from one of the local bars in Westport at Chubby's on Broadway overnight. And they were sitting there just talking about mob stuff. I don't know why. And I overheard them and I joined in the conversation a bit. And that's always kind of one of those little pieces I would say, that some of that original wiretap material, it's really like amazing because it's the actual person. And some of it, when you can hear it like that, like when he's like, do it.
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of like when we talked with Andrew DiDonato, and he's like, Gangland Wire.
Yeah.
With that Brooklyn accent.
I got some good little sound bites. It's just that, alone, they don't really mean anything. You got to have the context and all that, which is what Frank can provide as a context for that. Well, folks, I'm going to wind this down now. If you have a friend or relative who has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to like the Gangland Wire Facebook page. You need to subscribe to the Twitter at Gangland Wire and at Jenks Law. Follow Gary on the Twitter and then go over to the Instagram. Follow Gangland Wire on the Instagram, because when you see the posts, the episodes come up early Monday morning, you're going to want to go and subscribe so that you get that notice directly. It'll just email you moments after Gary releases great episodes, like this one with our interview with Frank Calabrese Jr. Then go to Amazon to buy Gangland Wire, the documentary that started it all, available for rent if you don't want to buy it, but we suggest you buy it. Or make a $25 donation at ganglandwire.com. If you live in the U.S., Gary will send you an autographed copy of the DVD, which has even more material that you can't get from Amazon. And if that's not enough, you need to go out and download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. Then get the book that Gary just finished, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
And when you're done reading that, you're going to want to get the Kindle for like $1.99. You can listen to the words from the mouth of the men that did it. The Kindle book has hyperlinks to video transcriptions with the actual audio from the Argent case that they used to end skimming from the Vegas casinos.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, everybody.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.
Anyhow,
we do that. Was it you said you can get that free 50 pages? Your Freedom of Information Act. And free 50 pages. We know the 50 pages we want. Yeah, it's the transcription of the wiretaps.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's different. That's like not in those case files. This is complicated stuff, Aaron. You don't understand. This
isn't just paperwork.
Immensely complicated stuff getting these government records that is hard and expensive. If you're really going to get it, you got to be ready to pay several thousand dollars. I got lucky here in Kansas City with that other one because I'm already a lawyer. And I got friends in the FBI here in Kansas City. I got connections. You don't have connections and you're not a lawyer, right there you're talking about a lot of money. And then the Freedom of Information Act requests are separate from anything gathered under Title III for the most part. You probably won't find anything under Title III or wiretap by just a Freedom of Information Act request. But it's complicated, as we say. We're belaboring this subject. That was, at Chicago.
Well, but that would be good audio. I guess that's my point. Maybe it wouldn't be. It would be muddled, and you would hear him talking about some of these murders. We didn't really ask Frank about the Spilotro brothers, and I think that's probably. I don't know, is that in his book or?
Yeah, that'll be in his
tour.
Book.
You know, save a little bit of that because that certainly is. You know, the probably one of the most famous murders in terms of Hollywood.
Yeah, I think he isn't the one that knew about it. It was his Uncle Nick. Knew about it, but yeah, they basically solved those murders. And actually, they found out that the guy who was buried those bodies didn't do a very good job of it. He got murdered. You know, in Chicago, if you remember the two guys that tried to kill Ken Ito and they didn't get him killed, what happened to them?
They got murdered.
They got murdered. Yeah, that's what Frank said. You know, his Uncle Nick knew that if he didn't get that guy killed, he was going to get killed, and his brother might get killed, and even his nephew might get killed.
He'd rather run out in the middle of the street and shoot the guy dead, catch a case because people would see him.
Yes.
That was the question I was trying to remember when we were talking with Frank Calabrese. What's the deal with loading your own rounds? Remember we talked about that with Frank?
We talked about it. Culotta knew about it. And
the whole Ken Ito thing.
Yeah, I don't know. Everybody's going to be different. I don't think they don't have like a booklet that they hand out to all the new guys and say, hey, now, if you're going to do a murder, use a .22 caliber pistol and lighten up on the round so you don't have to use a silencer.
Yeah.
So he may or may not have known about that. He did talk about making the silencer for the Sam Giancana gun, and he's right. They did find that gun. It was a .22 caliber pistol with a silencer on it. I've seen a picture of it, and they found it just a few blocks away from his house. Another interesting thing is he said that the FBI was on his house, and they didn't pull off. Now, the rumor, the myth has it that the police were sitting on his house and they got a call from some higher-ranking officer said to pull off, and then he got killed. But I just knew that wasn't right, but I never seen anybody refute that. But he just refuted that the FBI did not pull off. Now, for whatever reason,
they didn't notice that these killer guys go in. And
the killer is already dead. Probably what happened. Here's what I'm reading between the lines. I know a little bit about the FBI and police organizations in general. Is somebody probably went in there that they didn't see, killed him, and went back out, and they didn't see it because they were dogging off. And so they, you know, what are you going to say?
What's dogging off?
Dogging off, that's when you're like not paying attention to business. Now, they might have run. I mean, you're sitting on this guy. That's all you do is you sit on Sam Giancana, and he doesn't do anything.
Watch the house.
Week in and week out and week in and week out. So you got to go to the bathroom. You want to go get a cup of coffee. You want to go get a smoke or buy some smokes. Or you want to go get some ice cream.
Right. Worst time to be dogging off. when a guy gets killed.
Yeah. And so the Chicago outfit's a pretty sharp group of guys, if you notice, listening. You heard him what he talked about, how you would sit in a van for weeks running surveillance, because if you make a mistake, you go to jail for the rest of your life. If cops make a mistake, you know, so they made a mistake. Well, in this case, I would say the cops made a mistake, or the FBI agents made a mistake in pulling off for a little bit, and they were probably watching. They probably saw the surveillance crew pull off, and they were ready. As soon as the surveillance crew pulled off, they went in. They were granted entry into the house, I believe. It was a friend.
It wasn't a forced entry.
And there was no signs of struggle or anything. It's like he let a friend in, and the friend popped him, then turned around and walked right back out. So that would be my guess on that. Well, I'm anxious to see. He's right. Once he starts talking about that, that'll be all over the the Chicago Outfit Facebook pages. The best one out there is Mike Byrne and Redwood Metz, an administrator on it. Red has his own Facebook page, but Mike Burns' page, Chicago Outfit, old and new articles and stories, I think, or something like that. Just do Chicago Outfit Facebook page, and you'll find it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good one. There's two of them out there.
You know, I kind of wanted to ask him, but I didn't, I guess, because of La Pietra the Hook, and he's talking about having this club with a basement.
Yeah.
Like, well, did you ever find, you went down there and there was a hook hanging up? It seemed a little too close, you know, but he seemed to be pretty descriptive in terms of what that kind of, you know, and if you had a club upstairs and it's an 80s club, they're probably playing some, you know, disco music or something. And is that screaming? No, never mind. You wouldn't even hear it because, you know, they'd be having to turn them.
Oh, I thought you were talking about in here in the studio.
No, I know I was. You were looking at me like, did I just hear screaming? And somebody, I'm just affecting that because I would wonder, you know, if that
got William Axon Jackson strung up on a meat hook
down in the basement,
putting a kettle prod to his anus.
Yeah, he didn't.
Those guys were cruel. They were brutal up there. I've read so many stories about Chicago outfit people torturing guys.
I know Frank Calabrese said ice pick, but when you look online, it says cattle prod, it says blowtorch,
yeah.
And that the guys end up dying, they suffocate because they're screaming and they have the punctured lung.
Really? All right, that's enough of
brutal.
That. Brutal, horrible stuff.
Well, you know, if you've listened this long, then what you really need to do is go over to the ChicagoMobTours.com.
Yeah, he's got a bunch of videos on there too. Videos of him being interviewed, and then the videos of in the penitentiary with him and his dad. So I recommend you go there. It's pretty interesting.
And if you've listened to both of these episodes, then you're going to want to go ahead and come back. And when Gary posts them and you're listening and you're done, you're right to hear, you're going to want to go to our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/ganglandwire, and type in the secret word.
Yeah. Dusty Rhodes, was that it? Or oh, Rhodes?
I thought we were going to do a different
Rhodes.
Dusty Rhodes.
I still get Rhodes every once in a while from somebody. So.
I was going to say the hook.
Yeah, the hook. Let's keep it at Rhodes. They can remember that. If you listen to the post show that I put up, sometimes I'll put up some little outtakes. I've got a little bit for this one, and
but then
you
won't know if it was that one or the one we first did that in. Can you even remember which episode that was?
I don't know.
Right.
I don't know.
We have over 160 episodes.
We got too many. I've lost track. We just keep putting them out.